Welcome to the New Books in Political Science podcast. My name is Heath Brown, and today I have the pleasure to have Rick Hassan back on the podcast with his newest book. He's spoken before and is back now with his book, the title of which is The Justice of Contradictions, Antonin Scalia and the Politics of Disruption. The book is published by Yale University Press. Rick, how are you doing?
I'm doing well. Thanks so much for having me back on.
Absolutely. As people change and where they are and what they're doing, maybe you can just remind us and give us a little update on where you are.
So I'm a professor of law with a courtesy appointment in political science at the University of California, Irvine. I'm at the School of Law, and I teach election law and other courses that are somewhat related to the field of elections, as well as some other topics like torts and remedies. And this is really my first book that's outside the election law realm and looks more generally at a very interesting and provocative Supreme Court justice.
Yeah, absolutely. And the book is really interesting. I imagine very interesting for those that study the law specifically, but the political dimensions of this are also interesting and ones we will get to. For those that don't know Justice Scalia's background well, before we get to his jurisprudence, maybe we can just start talking a little bit about him as a person, and more importantly, about him as a lawyer rising through government. So who was Antonin Scalia before he became a member of the Supreme Court?
I'm happy to answer that question, but I should point out, just so that anyone who might pick up the book wouldn't be misled, my book is not a biography of Justice Scalia, and so I don't really delve much into his history. If you want to read an excellent biography of Justice Scalia, I recommend Joan Biskupic's book, American Original. Excellent look at kind of what made him tick behind the scenes. What I try to do is give more of an intellectual history of his ideas, a biography of his ideas, his ways of interpreting the Constitution and statutes. So the book's focused on that, but it does give it a little background. And I can tell you that Justice Scalia was a law professor. He taught at the University of Chicago before he ends up going first the Court of Appeals, the United States Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit and the Supreme Court. He worked in the Reagan administration. And so he had a career both in academia and in government before he entered into the judiciary.
So he's appointed to the court and brings some particular views and ways to do the job. The first that you discuss in the book is textualism. What you refer to as times is, in some ways, the word game approach to the law. I wonder if you can maybe talk about just what textualism is and how it plays out in Scalia's approach to some key cases.
Sure. And so just to kind of talk about where the court was before Justice Scalia came on, the Supreme Court handles cases that come up from state courts and federal courts. Some of those cases raise issues of interpreting the United States Constitution. You know, what does equal protection mean? But a large number of the cases don't involve constitutional issues, but they instead involve issues of the meaning of federal statutes. Sometimes even the court has to interpret what a state statute means. And the question is, how do you read a statute? How do you know what a statute means and apply it in a different situation? This comes up in all kinds of contexts, criminal and civil contexts. A lot of cases where this comes up involve interpretations of a federal statute passed by Congress by an administrative agency like the Environmental Protection Agency, and they've got their own interpretation. And before Scalia came on the court, the approach to how to understand what a statute means was somewhat haphazard and eclectic. Courts would look at all kinds of things. It would not be unheard of for the court to go on for pages without actually even quoting the statute. And Justice Scalia really tried to discipline the court in terms of how it looks at a statute by focusing on the words of the statute and what he called the ordinary meaning of those words, how an English speaker would understand the words at the time that they were written. And so he focuses on the meaning of language. He focused on the meaning of language so much so that sometimes his opinions look more like a grammar lesson than they do the kind of thing a court might do. And so it's fairly common today in cases involving the meaning of statutes and the use of focusing on the text for the justices to have a kind of dueling dictionaries section of their opinion, where one justice will cite one dictionary and that dictionary's definition of a particular word, and the dissenting justice might cite a different one. The court also relies on different rules of construction known as canons of construction. You know, what does it mean if you use a semicolon rather than a comma? What does it mean when you have a series of specifics followed by a general word? And there are all different kinds of rules that get applied here. And I would say that in the less controversial of the Supreme Court's cases, Justice Scalia's approach has been very influential. All the justices, whether they agree with Scalia or not overall, tend to now focus much more on the words of the statute than they used to. They're much more disciplined. The big divide between textualists and non-textualists is whether you can look at legislative history. And I think this is probably something your listeners would be very interested in. So when Congress is considering passage of a bill, there will be hearings, there will be floor statements, there will be a presidential signing statement. There'll be all kinds of material submitted into the record. How valuable is that material in understanding what a statute means? So, for example, there may be some words in a statute, and someone might have submitted a letter as to how that those words should be interpreted, or there may be a committee report that says something. Scalia believed that these legislative history materials should not and could not be consulted except in very rare circumstances, that they were unreliable, that they weren't the law, that it would be violating the judicial oath to consider them because this is not the law passed by Congress. And his argument was that this would rein in judges and give them less discretion. Now, I'm very critical of this view in the book, and I agree with Judge Robert Katzman, who's the chief judge of the United States Court of Appeals for the Second Circuit, that not looking at legislative history could actually make things worse in terms of discretion, in terms of getting it wrong, that sometimes this looks more like a parlor game when all the judges are doing is trying to look at grammar lessons rather than real-world problems that Congress was trying to solve. And sometimes it's very good evidence in the legislative history. Often it's not good evidence, but when it's there, it seems like you shouldn't put on blinders and stop yourself from looking at it.
This issue has played out in the recent debate in the court on the healthcare law. I wonder if you could talk about how that most recent of decisions played out with grammar and analysis of text.
Sure. So this was the second of two cases involving the Obamacare health law that the Supreme Court considered. This case was called King versus Burwell. It involved a technical question, but it had very large real-world implications. To understand the question, you need to know a little bit about the healthcare law. So it said that people who did not have private insurance or insurance through their employers could go and buy healthcare on what's called an insurance exchange. And the law provided that states could set up their own exchanges if they wanted. Some states, all Republican states, didn't set up these exchanges. And people who lived in those states, they bought insurance on what's called the federal exchange. And they would get their subsidies. And the argument in the case was that subsidies were available only to people who bought insurance on a state exchange, meaning anyone who bought insurance on an exchange that was a federal government exchange would lose their subsidies. The healthcare experts said this would cause a death spiral. The insurance markets would collapse if these subsidies disappeared. Justice Scalia, in dissent, argued that the words of the statutes, very long statutes, 2,000 pages, but there was one phrase that people could get subsidies on an exchange, quote, established by the state, that those people who are on a federal exchange were not eligible, and consequences be damned. If that meant the collapse of the exchange, that's not the court's problem. That's something for the Congress to solve. Now, he was in the dissent there. The majority, in an opinion by Chief Justice Roberts, who's not one of the court's liberals, joined by Justice Kennedy as well as the court's liberals, they also engaged in a textual analysis and said, reading the words in context, it was clear that established by the state would include the federal exchange as well. But they also looked at what the consequences would be, and they said it would be quite odd for Congress to have passed this 2,000-page law intending for it to have a secret provision in it that would cause it to go down a death spiral. And this is what I mean when I say that textualism is kind of like a parlor game where you're looking at the words in isolation and not taking into account the real-world consequences. And I contrast what Scalia did in that case with another case, and we probably don't have time to get into the details of that, but it was a case involving interpreting the federal rules of evidence. And in that case, Justice Scalia said, well, if the meaning of a statute is absurd, then we can just rewrite the statute. And that even Scalia was not a consistent textualist. And when he would deviate from textualism and when he would decide to comply with textualism, it almost always, not always, but almost always was leading him to results that were in line with a kind of conservative ideology. And I point out that Scalia and Justice Alito, both very conservative justices, Scalia used textualism and originalism, which was the constitutional side of this interpretation method. And Alito, who doesn't use those, they vote together in the tough cases almost all the time. And so even though Justice Scalia said he was adopting neutral principles, it seemed that most of the time his principles would lead him to a conservative political decision in these cases.
Yeah, and you mentioned originalism, which is at least one of the other methods that Scalia and others use. Would you talk a little bit about how originalism differs from textualism? Because from a distance, they might seem to be a similar method, but they really are different. And whether this is a choice for Scalia between the two, and whether sort of your thesis that this sometimes fits his ideology, is it when the textualism argument aligns with his ideology and when the originalism does the opposite? So maybe just talk a little bit about originalism and how it fits into Scalia's approach.
Sure. So while textualism is the approach that applies to understanding the meaning of statutes in Scalia's world, originalism, or what we might call original meaning or original public meaning originalism, is how Scalia approached the interpretation of constitutional provisions. What does it mean in the context to talk about cruel and unusual punishment or equal protection of the laws? Now, there are different versions of originalism. There are some versions of originalism which Scalia disagreed with, that, for example, looked at the original intent of the framers. Well, what would the framers have thought about this question, the people who actually drafted the Constitution? There was one moment in an oral argument in a case involving a First Amendment challenge to California's ban on the sale of violent video games to minors, where Justice Alito at oral argument says, I think what Justice Scalia wants to know is, what did James Madison think about video games? Did he enjoy them? Which got a big laugh from the crowd. Right. And Scalia said, no, that's not what I think. Scalia said, I'm not an original meaning kind of, I'm not an original intent person. I'm an original public meaning originalist. And what he meant by that was, what did the words mean at the time that the Constitution was, or the constitutional amendment was adopted? Now, on the surface, this sounds just like textualism. You're asking what the meaning of the words were at the time. But when it came to constitutional interpretation, Scalia would sometimes look not only at the question of what the words meant at the time, but what was the social practice at the time. So to give one very stark example, the Equal Protection Clause, passed and ratified in the 1860s after the Civil War, provides, this is part of the 14th Amendment, that a person cannot be deprived by the state of equal protection of the laws. Now, look at those words by themselves. Does this provision ban discrimination on the basis of gender? And Scalia said no, because no one at the time that the 14th Amendment was ratified would have thought that it would have given these rights of, say, women to raise claims of sex discrimination. That's an interpretation of the Constitution by looking not just at what the word said and what the word equal might have meant to someone at the time that the Constitution was ratified, but also at the social context. Now, social context is really hard to figure out even today, but to go back in time over 100 years and figure out what that meant 150 years, I think is kind of almost impossible. But here, too, Scalia was not always consistent. So, for example, when it comes to the question of affirmative action, giving preferences on the basis of race to make up for past racial discrimination, Scalia said, you can't do it. Just look at the words of the statute. Equal means equal. And let's, you know, and we can read the words and we know what they mean. Well, it turns out that at the time that the 14th Amendment was ratified, Congress passed what we would consider to be laws that gave preferences to newly freed slaves, a kind of form of affirmative action. And so sometimes Scalia would look at the text of the statute, the text of the constitutional provision alone, and sometimes he would look at social context. In both of those examples, it led him to conservative results. And so I really do question how much of the ideology that animated what Scalia and what all of the justices did was more important to him than the methods he said that he used to interpret statutes or constitutional provisions. You want to know how the court's going to decide a case? It's much easier to decide that by knowing whether the president that appointed the justice was a Democrat or Republican than whether or not someone's going to make an originalist or textualist argument.
Now, you're not the only one to question some of these contradictions or inconsistencies. You relate a couple of cases where Scalia was questioned, one by Alan Dershowitz and then by Judge Posner. I wonder if you could recount these interactions he had, some of them quite public, and how Scalia responded when he was called to question on not being as consistent as he might think he was being.
Yeah, so it would be fairly common that when Scalia would give a public lecture or speech, that he would take questions, and be fairly common to get a question that would say, you know, you're not being consistent in your originalism, or how do you justify this? And most of the time, his response was to laugh it off. And so you mentioned an example of Alan Dershowitz. Dershowitz, a professor at Harvard Law School, asked him about originalism in a criminal case. And he said, as Sarah Palin might say, I'll have to get back to you. excuse me. There were other instances in which one instance I recount in the book involves Jeffrey Rosen, who's a law professor and writer for The Atlantic, who was with Scalia at a dinner party and called him out on the question of whether Brown versus Board of Education, saying that separate but equal schools is inherently unconstitutional, whether that could be justified on originalist grounds, and trying to point out some of the history of what we know at the time. And Scalia's laughed it off and said, well, no theory is perfect. He was asked to review a book by the Yale law professor Jack Balk, and he was asked by the University of Chicago Law Review to review the book. It was a book that was critical of Scalia's views of originalism and presented a different view of originalism. And Scalia said, I can't review the book because I'm not going to read the book. He said, I followed Disraeli's maxim, never complain, never explain. Scalia did some complaining, but he rarely did explaining. He rarely responded to his critics. And he often bristled at the criticism, even though he could be quite sharp and nasty when he was disagreeing with either other justices on the Supreme Court or others making arguments in the public realm. He was sometimes quite vicious in his attacks, but he was able to dish it out more than he was able to take it in a lot of these public settings.
Now, he occasionally laughs this off, but the influence of Scalia is hard to underestimate, and some of that is with through organizations like the Federalist Society, which you talk about in the book. I wonder if you talk a little bit about the influence that Scalia has had through the Federalist Society in advancing this sometimes inconsistent and contradictory view of how to rule on cases. And so this is part of the legacy as well. So maybe you can talk about how widely accepted Scalia's approach has been.
As I mentioned, there are other justices on the Supreme Court who are quite conservative, Justice Alito, to some extent, Chief Justice Roberts. They're quite conservative, but they don't buy into his originalist and textualist modes of interpretation. But I think that just like we've seen the Republican Party coalesce around Trump as times have changed, I think we've seen most lawyers on the conservative side coalesce around Scalia's approach to textualism and originalism, in part because Scalia was one of the early leaders of the Federalist Society, a group of conservative and libertarian lawyers, judges, and law students. And Scalia presented the idea that not only are other means of interpretation incorrect, but they are illegitimate. And it has served the tools of originalism and textualism have served as a basis for delegitimizing the more liberal decisions that the Supreme Court has come out with on things like same-sex marriage or in the Obamacare case that we've mentioned. And so I think it's very likely that most of the judges and justices coming up through the Federalist Society and then joining the bench are likely to embrace Scalia's views of how to interpret the Constitution, how to interpret statutes. One great example of that is Neil Gorsuch, the newest Supreme Court justice, who I think has been quite an acolyte of Scalia, someone who is parroting his lines. In one of Gorsuch's first opinions, he wrote something like, well, if there's a problem with how Congress has drafted the statute, there's a solution for that. It's called legislation. Or at the argument in the partisan gerrymandering case out of Wisconsin, which we're still waiting to hear how the court's going to decide it. At one point, Gorsuch says at oral argument, can we get back to this arcane matter, the Constitution, as though only he is focused on what the Constitution provides and the other justices are doing something else. And so I think that there's no question that Justice Scalia's approach, at least in the short to medium term, is going to be emulated by other conservative judges and justices on the Supreme Court and is likely to have a lot of influence. Scalia may have more influence in his death than he did in his life. He wasn't a justice who wrote a lot of majority opinions in key cases. He wasn't the justice who was the swing justice, the one who was moving 5-4 majorities one way or the other. He was a solid conservative, but his ideas and his writing were so influential that they really seem to have some staying power right now.
Yeah, the book title again is The Justice of Contradictions, Antonin Scalia and the Politics of Disruption, published this year by Yale University Press. Rick Hazen, thank you so much for your time today.
It's been a pleasure talking to you.